the economic union, which have, of course, have had over 500 years of dominance to get things right, and have done nothing but mess up. And I have to confess, as a person of European descent, you know, I'm part of that, and I'm taking the benefit of it. But it's time for a change, and the kind of change that's required is not breaking down traditional values in regional countries and clearing the way, or so that multinational corporations from the United States and Great Britain and Europe more generally can come in and do business with billionaires in places like India, so that at the top end of the human scrap heap, they're lapping it all up and doing well and saying GDP is growing, while people at the bottom are suffering more than ever with rising prices and lower wages. So I don't think this is the way to go. I see it happening around the world. I see it happening here in Indonesia. I see a calculated effort to break down traditional values and clear the way with false promises for Western corporations to come in and cover the field and establish monopolies and oligopolies that basically put small businesses out of business.
According to Indian economists, foreign firms won't be able to compete with the local firms, thus incurring higher costs compared to national companies. Underwater structure projects involving large-scale medical equipment or artificial intelligence are the areas where the foreign companies have an edge over the local businesses. Cost being the major factor, the competition in majority of sectors is with ASEAN countries or China. As per the agreement, procurement has been open to UAE companies in 34 central government ministries, including Ministry of Economic Affairs, New and Renewable Energy, Power, etc.
Allowing access to the UAE to procure government tenders has resulted in the opening of the floodgates to similar demands from other countries India is negotiating with. These include the European Union, the UK and Australia. The agreement with the UAE is being used as a benchmark by other negotiating countries. Additionally, countries with which India already has FTAs may push for including access to $500 billion Indian government procurement market in the agreements.
In a surprising move, India and the European Union resumed negotiations in June 2022 for a free trade agreement after almost a decade. EU's demands include inclusion of concessions extended to other FTA partners, namely UAE, along with duty cuts on automobiles, dairy products. India also has ongoing talks with the UK, Australia, and Canada. All these countries are eyeing the Indian central government procurement market. According to the Indian government officials, the UK and EU will not negotiate if the public procurement market is kept out of the trade talks. Australia has also been asking for similar access as given to the UAE.
Well, I think it's very difficult to ever conceive of a situation that has large corporations facing a threat from smaller, more efficient companies. I don't think the business sector, the private sector, works that way. The way corporatism works, basically, is huge corporations come into a country, whether it's by making promises or through corrupt payments or whatever it takes, and initially perform in order to be able to say, look, we're delivering a better product at a lower price, which helps everybody, including consumers. But once they've established themselves, they're like a caterpillar or a moth. They metamorphosize into something horrible that destroys all other possibilities, including local smaller businesses. It's very difficult for small businesses to survive, let alone threaten the supremacy of big corporations in a place where corporations have been allowed to come in and basically dominate the roost. So I don't see there being a scenario once these multinational corporations start coming in and doing trade with India, which understandably is primarily concerned about its own economic interests, that sees ordinary small businesses and medium-sized businesses and domestic businesses and individuals protected from what's going to play out. This is all part of the grander scheme for U.S. hegemony, or if you like, Atlantic world hegemony, where everybody's dancing to a set of rules that's drafted in America.
According to the experts, if a national treatment clause is included in the FDA's, it would mean similar treatment to foreign small companies. Given that foreign micro, small, and medium enterprises are very strong, it would create stiff competition for their domestic counterparts. The economists regard this as the real cause of concern, as providing a particular area means agreement to give access to other areas. Public procurement, being a huge market, is always preferred. In both scenarios, Indian businesses face danger of foreign entities entering the domestic market and increasing competition.
So we have discussed public procurement as part of free trade agreements of India with different countries. Now, let's switch to social media and see what people around the world had to say on this issue.
Let's now take a look at what the global media has to say about it. Mark Warner tweeted, "Public procurement of contracts worth over 200 crore rupees were opened up in the FTA signed with the UAE last year, and now every country India is negotiating with, including the EU, UK and Australia, is gunning for access to the public procurement market." John G. Murphy, an economic expert, wrote, "UK expects to strike FTA with India and accede to TPP in 2023, reports Bloomberg. The administration's view that FTAs are passé is a lonely one. Shantanu Singh, an economist, tweeted, "People aware of the development said that Indian companies, especially those in the IT sector, have also sought access to the public procurement market in the EU and the UK. Mint, a news portal, wrote, "The inclusion of public procurement in the UAE agreement marked a first for India, which has been notoriously shy of opening up this lucrative market to foreign companies."
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Contrary to the claims of the Modi-led BJP government, the intensity of attacks on the civilian population in Jammu and Kashmir has increased in recent years. These attacks have mainly been aimed on the minority Kashmiri Pandit community and the non-resident Hindus living in Kashmir. Experts say that the armed group's strategy to attack the non-locals and minorities is a way to signal opposition to the means employed by the Bharatiya Janata Party to change the demography of the Muslim-majority region.
With the start of the new year, the state of Jammu and Kashmir witnessed the killing of four civilians in the Rajouri district by unidentified gunmen. Two more people, including a child, died the following day when a blast rocked the area. Conflicting with the return of normalcy as claimed by the BJP government, at least 18 non-local Hindus and Kashmiri Pandits have been killed since the abrogation of Article 370. According to the data provided by the government of India, the violence has seen no downward trend since the revocation of the statehood in the year 2019. The Modi-led BJP government had cited the special status of Jammu and Kashmir as the primary reason for violence. 229 armed attacks were recorded in the year 2021, leading to 40 civilian killings. The number went to 30 civilian killings in the year 2022. In the years 2017 and 2016, 279 and 322 attacks were reported, thus showing no significant improvement in the situation, as wrongly portrayed by New Delhi. The central BJP government has been asserting that the abrogation of Article 370 brought normalcy to the violence-ridden region. However, the opposite appears to be true. In the year 2013, prior to Modi's coming to power, only 170 cases of violence were reported from the Himalayan region.
Contrary to the popular belief that the COVID-19 pandemic has wreaked havoc to the economy of Jammu and Kashmir, statistics show a different picture. After the abrogation of Article 370, the investments in the region dropped from $72.3 million in 2018-2019 to $36.3 million in the year 2019-2020. According to the government of India's recent figures, the investment has decreased by more than 50% since the revocation of the special status of the Himalayan region.
The claim that the abrogation of the semi-autonomous status of the state will lead to economic development in the region has failed on the ground. Last year in December, India's Minister of State for Home Affairs, Nityanand Rai, gave figures about the economic status of Jammu and Kashmir. According to the statistics, the investments in the region have fallen by 55% in the past 4 years. Previously blaming the local governments for the economic backwardness in the region, the BJP government in New Delhi has not been able to put the Union Territory directly ruled by the center on the road to economic development as had been promised earlier. According to the data published by the Indian Ministry of Home Affairs, the total investment in the year 2017 to 2018 was $102.8 million, considerably decreasing to $50.5 million in the year 2019 to 2022. And in 2021 to 2022, the investments were recorded to be $46 million, thus laying bare the false claims of economic growth in the region. Earlier, Modi-led BJP government would cite restrictions on the procurement of land as the main reason for economic backwardness of the Himalayan region. However, after the abrogation of Article 370, the government still has not been able to bring private sector investment to the state, thus ruining the economy further.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mr. Abdullah Khan from Islamabad. He's the Managing Director of Pakistan Institute for Conflict and Security Studies. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, contrary to the rosy picture painted by the BJP government, the civilian killings of the non-resident Hindus and Kashmir Pandits have increased. So the question is, do you think the armed groups have changed their tactics after the abrogation of Article 370?
First of all, we all should condemn the killing of civilian for whatever pretext somebody is doing this. Nobody can justify killings of civilians by any means, whether they are pandits or non-Kashmiri residents or whoever. Having said this, that I think that the civilian pandits, Kashmiri pandits, or the non-resident Kashmiris are being made cannon fodder by the Indian government. Indian government has a plan to change the demography of occupied state of Jammu and Kashmir. For that, they are bringing in non-Kashmiris in the state of Jammu and Kashmir. And they have changed not just the state of the disputed state, but also they have changed the laws about the domiciles and the residence. So that has enabled them to bring non-resident Kashmiris. And by doing this, actually the BJP government is fueling tension between different religions. So because the demographic changes being made in Kashmir are based on the religion, because predominantly Kashmir is a Muslim majority state, and which should have been something India could have taken pride in that, that it has a state which is majority Muslim state, and that suited the Indian claim of secularism. But since the BJP is in power, which is a Hindu, fascist, and nationalist government, they are trying to change the demography on the basis of Hindu Muslims. So they are bringing in more Hindus, and which are actually creating troubles for the Hindu pandits, which are Kashmiris and very much state subject. They lived there for centuries, And they used to have very cordial relations with the Muslim majority of the state of Jammu and Kashmir. But now they are also in trouble because of these political policies of BJP, which I think which will not only backfire within Kashmir, but elsewhere in India as well.
Now, Mr. Khan, citing the special status as a roadblock to the economic development of the region, statistics show that investments in the region have fallen by 55%. Now, conflicting with the claims, has the withdrawal of the special status been responsible for the decrease in economic investments?
Hey, you know, this is very interesting that the BJP says that after abrogation of special status to Kashmir, they will bring in investment. While destroying the economy of Kashmiri traders and Kashmiri businessmen for almost now 10 years, consistently destroying the local economy, how can you actually improve the economic condition of the state, the people of the state? This is, I think, not understandable to common sense that local economy, you know, the blockade of the Kashmiri traders, it remained for months. And the Kashmir is practically in siege for almost 2 years now, and 2.5 years now. And you claim that you will bring investment, and that is not possible. And as you mentioned, the statistics have shown that it is not possible. Actually, it is hypocrisy at its best. Whatever the BJP government is trying to do in Kashmir is actually to strengthen its occupation. And for that, their sole objective is to weaken the will of the local people by whatever means. And they are trying to bring in, as I earlier mentioned, non-resident people. And now they are trying to bring in the business community of India into Kashmir while depriving the local businessmen of their own businesses. This is ridiculous. You cannot actually prosper as a state or a territory while the local people are deprived of their basic livelihoods and you are bringing in other investors. That's not possible. And this is the, this is the basic objective the Modi had presented Kashmir as a business hub for non-resident business community to come in and to benefit from the tourism and other businesses available in Kashmir. And the sole objective is actually to destroy the local businesses. Now, I think that will not work. Whatever India try, that will not work for India and not for the people of the Kashmir.
Mr. Khan, we've seen that violence in the region has not improved in the past few years as claimed by the BJP government. So has the center's iron fist policy turned counterproductive in the Himalayan region?
History is a teacher, but we tend not to listen from it, not to learn from it. Everybody knows that you cannot crush the will of the people by iron fist or whatever strict policies you adopt. This is not for the first time India is adopting very strict policies. India killed more than 100,000 people in Kashmir, but the Kashmiri people never, ever, bowed down in front of Indian pressure. They still demand their right of self-determination, and this is the will of the people. You know, whatever India uses sometimes stick, sometimes carrot policy for the people of Kashmir. Sometimes they try to appease them, sometimes they try to coerce them. But both have failed in the past and both will fail in the past in future as well, because the people of Jammu and Kashmir want to have their right of self-determination. And India should actually give them the opportunity to exercise their right, which India itself had committed under the UN Security Council resolutions. And it was basically India which took Kashmir issue into United Nations, not Pakistan. India was losing the war at that time because the Kashmiri people had taken up arms, and this Azad Kashmir and Gilgit Baltistan, that was liberated by the people. And India was fearful that Srinagar was about to fall, and when India took that to UN Security Council, now India is obliged to fulfill its own commitments at international forums. which India is denying and which will cost India miserably in the future.
Now, Mr. Khan, last but not least, the incidence of violence in Kashmir has seen a downward trend before Modi's coming to power. So the question is, has the anti-Muslim policy of the BJP further alienated the people of the region and pushed them to the wall?
Actually, if we see the violence of the Kashmiri militant groups against the Indian state, that is irrespective of who is in power in the center, whether it is BJP, whether it is Congress, whether it is a united front of different political parties. The Kashmiri people are actually resistant against the occupation of India, and they want to exercise their right of self-determination, which was deprived by India. So the basic thing is that the militant groups, they will carry their work, whether it is BJP, whether it is some other government. But having said that, the strict policies which in BJP has applied on Kashmir, it actually help the militant groups to recruit more and more Kashmiri youth. There was a time that then there was a mix of non-Kashmiri and Kashmiri militants. Now we are seeing that majority of the militants operating in Kashmir are purely the Kashmiri youth. So that is a phenomena which changed during the BJP's government, that more youth is being radicalized in Kashmir and they are joining different militant groups. And this is for the first time in the history of Kashmir that during BJP's government, we have seen the presence of Daesh in Kashmir and we have seen presence of Al-Qaeda in Kashmir. It never happened. So that is the level of, suppression and depression among the Kashmiri youth, which can actually become catastrophic for India and for the region as well. So that is something which is new in Kashmir, and that is the result of the BJP's policies.
There you have it, Mr. Abdullah Khan from Islamabad. He's the managing director of Pakistan Institute for Conflict and Security Studies. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Sharp Media Network tweeted, "No developments in Indian illegally occupied Jammu and Kashmir during last 4 years. The last 4 years have ruined the entire economy of Jammu and Kashmir, which has in reality collapsed. Unemployment is at its peak and youth is in utter frustration." Frontier Indica wrote, "It's no secret that under Modi, the security situation in Punjab has gotten much worse, and the benefits of revocation of Article 370 vis-a-vis the safety of common people in J&K, especially KPs, have also been short-lived." The Wire, a prominent news portal, tweeted, "The people of Kashmir say silence, fear, rising prices, and unemployment have taken over the region after August 5, 2019. Jammu-based reserve category employee working in Kashmir tweeted, "Situation in Kashmir is not yet conducive, but still being forced to resume duties. I don't know why. We are not with any NEZ security and weapon to defend ourselves, still forced by stopping salaries. Our life is also valuable to our old parents, if yours matters to your parents."
And that was our episode about the FTA's public procurement and the apprehensions of Indian business houses, and also the worrying economic and security situation in Jammu and Kashmir. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight. After 4 months of intense negotiations, Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak could announce a Northern Ireland protocol deal on Monday, 27th of February, marking an end to a 2-year standoff with the European Union. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is poised to announce a deal to end the protracted row over the post-Brexit Northern Ireland protocol as soon as Monday, 27th of February. The move would come after 4 months of intense negotiations and mark an end to a 2-year standoff with the European Union. But in a huge political gamble for the Prime Minister, it may trigger a fresh battle with pro-Brexit Conservative backbenchers in the European Research Group and the Democratic Unionist Party, the DUP. Tentatively said to have been named the Windsor Agreement, the deal would overhaul post-Brexit arrangements in Northern Ireland. Number 10 Downing Street hopes it will also pave the way for the re-establishment of an assembly in Stormont, given power sharing has been suspended since the Democratic Unionist Party, the DUP's first minister, resigned over the protocol in February of 2022. According to reports on Friday night, Ursula von der Leyen, the European Commission president, was scheduled to meet Britain's King Charles on Saturday as a final flourish in sealing the deal, but that was cancelled earlier in the day. MPs in the House of Commons have been put on a three-line whip to attend Parliament on Monday, and Cabinet ministers are braced for a potential conference call over the weekend. Discussions are still underway in Downing Street about inviting Ursula von der Leyen to the United Kingdom for a handshake to seal the deal. Von der Leyen and Rishi Sunak spoke on Friday afternoon, their third meeting in a week, fueling speculation that a deal was at the presentation stage. Number 10 Downing Street sources did not confirm whether a deal would be announced in the coming days, but stressed talks were continuing and that any discussion of timing was purely speculative. Earlier this week, prominent MPs in the European Research Group, including its deputy chair David Jones, warned that if Rishi Sunak's deal involved a tweak of the existing arrangements, it would amount to nothing more than a glossary on how to implement the protocol. The European Research Group has said it is in lockstep with the DUP, the Democratic Unionist Party, which has indicated it will not support the deal unless it ends the application of European Union law in Northern Ireland, which is the bedrock of the protocol and highly unlikely to happen. British government sources claimed the Prime Minister was relaxed about the threat of a backlash from the European Research Group and the DUP because he believes the deal would address all their concerns, including checks on goods and food produce entering Northern Ireland from Great Britain and the constitutional right to be treated the same as any other country within the United Kingdom on trade matters. The Northern Ireland Secretary, Chris Heaton-Harris, held an unscheduled meeting with the European Union's chief Brexit negotiator, Maros Sefcovic, on Thursday, according to one insider. They said Chris Heaton-Harris was determined to go for the face-to-face summit to reassure Brussels that the British government was fully aware of the European Research Group's anxieties and would be pressing ahead despite the backlash. This was a reassurance mission, not a rescue mission, the source said. Chris Heaton-Harris is seen as an experienced judge of the mood of the Conservative Party, having served as chief whip previously. But concerns at Number 10 Downing Street are growing that Boris Johnson, the former Prime Minister, could double down on the critical intervention he made about Rishi Sunak's handling of the Brexit negotiations last weekend. Sammy Wilson, The Democratic Unionist Party's Brexit spokesperson said the former Prime Minister was helping the European Research Group and unionists ensure the Northern Ireland Protocol Bill, which would allow Britain to unilaterally rip up some Brexit arrangements for Northern Ireland, made it to the statute books. It was Boris Johnson who agreed the protocol deal in October of 2019 in order to bolster his chances at the December election with his claim of an oven-ready Brexit for the electorate. The bill is seen as a backdrop to ensure the protocol is overhauled, but it has been paused in the Parliament in the House of Commons since mid-October, where the European Union has pushed for it to be dropped. Sammy Wilson, the DUP's Brexit spokesperson, told the Chopper's Politics podcast that Boris Johnson had a duty to help because, after all, he was the person who got us into this situation. On Friday, the Foreign Secretary, James Cleverly, told Times Radio he hoped any deal, if it were sealed, would address the conditions laid down by the Democratic Unionist Party, the DUP. "When hopefully we get those issues resolved, then I would hope that the DUP would recognise that we've addressed their concerns. And until we have addressed those concerns, we're not going to sign off on the deal," James Cleverly said. The comments signalled a reluctance by some in government to press ahead with the agreement with the DUP and risk rattling senior European Union figures. Those involved in the negotiations have tightly guarded the substance of the deal, but informed sources said it involved a carve-out for all goods that could be shown to be consumed within Northern Ireland. This would give suppliers to supermarkets, corner shops, canteens in hospitals and schools the right to trade as they did before Brexit, with no customs declaration or security and safety certificates. In order to enforce it, there would be hefty fines for any businesses caught smuggling non-compliant goods into Northern Ireland and then exporting them onwards to the EU. There is also expected to be a fudge on the role of the European Court of Justice, removing the EU's right to automatically go to the European Court of Justice in the event of a claimed infraction of EU law. The BBC has also covered the same story and tells us more. A deal on post-Brexit rules for Northern Ireland could be announced in the coming days, Britain and EU sources have indicated to the BBC. It comes after plans to sign off an agreement between the two sides earlier this week were delayed. Developments are said to be moving hour by hour, and a deal could still fail to materialise. Number 10 Downing Street told reporters earlier that intensive discussions with the European Union were ongoing. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has been trying to win support for changes to post-Brexit rules for Northern Ireland, known as the Northern Ireland Protocol. Rishi Sunak spoke to EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen earlier. Downing Street said on Friday evening that Mr. Sunak had made good progress during the call, with a source saying it was positive and negotiations would continue, with the leaders agreeing to discuss this further in the coming days. It is also understood that Rishi Sunak was meeting with a number of big food retailers. One major supermarket has told the BBC that it was their understanding that a deal has been reached. But the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, wants the backing of retailers.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes. Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Another missile test by North Korea. Four long-range cruise missiles. This particular test, however, was different. Even North Korea's media reported it that way. Strategic cruise missiles designed to demonstrate its ability to conduct a nuclear counterattack. The key word, counterattack. North Korea has been very clear about its missile tests, and there's nothing new there. It has been in response to the U.S. joint war games in the region, whether with South Korea or Japan. However, now it has described the weapons as strategic, suggesting that they are being developed with the intent to arm them with nuclear warheads. The scenario of North Korea's missile launches and the types of ballistic missiles came into full gear in the year 2022, during the U.S. presidency of Joe Biden. North Korea fired more than 70 ballistic missiles, the most ever. But why would these launches increase so much during Joe Biden's tenure? One reason: the U.S. lack of a foreign policy approach towards North Korea. Just war games and condemnations. The U.S. has even flown B-52 bombers in its war games. High-ranking U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham once said, quote, "If there's going to be a war to stop Kim Jong-un, it will be over there. If thousands die, they're going to die over there." Sanctions have been exhausted. Yet what has been missing is diplomacy or some kind of peace process. But the U.S. has no appetite for that. The U.S. track record shows that it chooses military solutions to foreign policy problems. But why, when in the case of North Korea, given that it has intercontinental ballistic missiles capable of reaching the U.S. mainland? In the past, the U.S. has used the preventive approach. The U.S. has in its attack doctrine preventive strikes, which differ from preemptive strikes in that they would not be a response to imminent attack from an enemy. Preventive military action has become a popular option among U.S. officials, culminating with George W. Bush's invasion of Iraq. But there's a more important reason. The U.S. may simply use this approach towards North Korea in order to make it give concessions. That, along with the U.S.'s long-sought prize, China. The U.S.'s coming war with China is now perceived as not a matter of if, but when. The telltale signs are there. From the U.S. national security reports, which cite China as the number one threat to U.S. national security, to arming allies in the region, like Japan, the Philippines, and Taiwan. For example, Tokyo just recently announced a record 26.3% increase in its defense spending, which will include missiles capable of reaching China. And then there is Taiwan, which aside from arming it to the tune of billions of dollars, the U.S. will be sending more troops to the island. The U.S. proxy war in Ukraine, possible showdown with Russia, its military threats against Iran, and its potential conflict with North Korea and China. Open Society Foundations described it best when it said, "America is in a constant state of war, and its founding values are approaching annihilation."
Malcolm X was the iconic leader of African American Muslims and a civil rights activist who was assassinated 58 years ago. The iconic leader was born in 1925 and was jailed for robbery in 1946. In prison, he was introduced to the Nation of Islam and became influenced by the teachings of his leader. He was assassinated at the age of 39 on the 21st of February 1965 by three men. Now, after 58 years, his daughter says federal agencies concealed evidence of his murder and she intends to sue the FBI, the CIA, New York City Police, and others for his death. Eliza Shabazz accused various federal and New York government agencies of fraudulently concealing evidence. She claimed the evidence shows the agency conspired to assassinate Malcolm X. Shabazz says she seeks $100 million in damages.
For years, our family has fought for the truth to come to light concerning his murder, and we'd like our father to receive the justice that he deserves. The truth about the circumstances leading to the death of our father is important not only to his family, but to many followers, many admirers, many who look to him for guidance, for love. And it is our hope that litigation of this case will finally provide some unanswered questions. We want justice served for our father. Thank you.
The slaying of the black leader has been the subject of speculation about the potential involvement of secret government agencies in his assassination. Back then, the FBI infiltrated black rights movements in a bid to dismantle them. Malcolm X was a lead spokesman for the Nation of Islam. The group advocated separatism for black Americans. Malcolm X later split from the organization and toned down some of his radical views. In the 1950s, the United States reckoned with its prevalent racism, and Malcolm X's assassination was a turning point back then. The civil rights movement, which was a campaign to abolish racial segregation, discrimination, and disenfranchisement throughout the United States, culminated in the 1960s. Various individuals and groups, most notably Martin Luther King, struggled to rid the United States of its institutional racism. But despite years of struggle and some success, structural racism is still rampant in the U.S.
It has failed, and it's very tragic. There's been so much suffering. You know, even when there is progress in the 1960s during what's often referred to as the civil rights movement, the liberation movement, there were gains made, but at the same time that there were legislative remedies made, immediately we see the mass incarceration system beginning. And we see neoliberalism taking hold, which impoverished so many millions of people.
The median household income for black people is 37% less than that of white people. And black people are also less likely to benefit from home ownership, the engine of generational wealth in America. Black couples are also more than twice as likely as their white counterparts to be denied a mortgage or a home improvement loan. Furthermore, only about 5.7% of physicians in the U.S. identify as black or African American. This statistic does not reflect the communities they serve, as an estimated 12% of the U.S. population is black or African American. One reason for this disproportionate number is that black people have been historically excluded from medicine, and life expectancy has declined slightly for African Americans. A black child born today is likely to live up to 74.7 years, 4 years less than a white baby.
So with if there is not a commitment at the top, if there's not seriousness about acknowledging racism and its impact, then we end up with the situation where we're in now, where the U.S. continually claims to be this racism-free country, when in fact it is anything but.
In a State of the Nation address in Moscow, Russian President Vladimir Putin has defended Moscow's military operation in Ukraine. Putin accused the US-led NATO alliance of fanning the flames of the conflict in the mistaken belief that it could defeat Moscow in a global confrontation. He blamed the West for starting the conflict in Ukraine, saying Western countries led by the United States were seeking unlimited power in world affairs. The Russian president said Moscow was not fighting the people of Ukraine, stressing that Ukraine has become a hostage of the Kyiv regime and its Western masters, which have effectively occupied the country. He also accused the US-led NATO of using the conflict as a pretext to supply Kyiv with arms and munitions. Putin warned that the more long-range weapons are sent to Ukraine, the longer Russia will push threats away from its borders. In an important announcement, Putin said Russia was suspending participation in a major arms control agreement with the US.
I have to say that Russia suspends its participation in the New START treaty. Let me repeat, Russia does not abandon the treaty, but suspends its participation in it.
The New START treaty was signed in Prague in 2010. It came into force the following year and was extended in 2021 for 5 more years after United States President Joe Biden took office. It caps the number of strategic nuclear warheads that the US and Russia can deploy and deployment of land and submarine-based missiles and bombers to deliver them. Together, Russia and the US hold about 90% of the world's nuclear warheads. Putin also hailed the resistance of the Russian economy in the face of massive sanctions by the West.
As I already mentioned, the West is launching not just a military and informational war against us, but has also opened an economic front. But it is achieving nothing nowhere and will not achieve anything.
He added that the Russian economy has managed to do well despite Western countries' predictions of its collapse. Russian President Vladimir Putin's annual speech coincided U.S. President Joe Biden's unannounced trip to Ukraine and Poland. Biden stepped up his anti-Russia rhetoric during his trip. He pledged more arms for Kyiv and a fresh round of sanctions against Russia during a meeting with his Ukrainian counterpart Volodymyr Zelensky. Biden proclaimed unwavering support for Kyiv and a commitment to bolstering NATO's eastern flank facing Russia. Biden's trip has also drawn criticism from inside America. Conservative Republicans have censured his decision to travel to an active war zone without a significant American military presence. They argue that instead Biden should have visited the border with Mexico or the Ohio town stricken by toxic waste spilled from a derailed train. Kevin Hearn, a House Republican from Oklahoma, who chairs the influential Republican Study Committee, said the presidents now spend more time in Kyiv than he has at our southern border. House Republican David Kostoff said there are a lot of people here in the U.S. that would say he probably should have gone to Ohio and visited with the people who have been afflicted by the derailment first. Also, the right-wing American lawmaker Marjorie Taylor Greene said Biden chose Ukraine over America, while forcing the American people to pay for Ukraine's government and war. I cannot express how much Americans hate Joe Biden. The comments from Republicans were in many ways business as usual for the Biden presidency. The GOP has hammered him since practically the start of his administration for the increase in migrant arrivals on the southern border and more recently seized on the East Palestine derailment to argue his administration is turning a blind eye to an environmental disaster. East Palestine's mayor, Trent Conaway, said that Biden's Ukraine trip was the biggest slap in the face. That tells you right now he doesn't care about people. Last month, Biden visited Texas's border with Mexico shortly after he announced new restrictions on migrants who arrive in the United States, which drew opposition from advocacy groups and progressive Democrats. But the comments from the Republican lawmakers could also be harbingers of major political battles to come. Since the beginning of the war, the U.S. has supplied Kyiv with about $30 billion worth of weaponry and other aid, but the country has asked for more. That will require the agreement of both the Biden administration and his Democratic allies controlling the Senate, as well as the Republicans in control of the House of Representatives. A year has passed since the ongoing war in Ukraine broke out. Despite calls for dialogue and a peaceful solution to end the conflict, Western nations, particularly the U.S., have fanned the flames of war by sending billions of dollars in arms to Ukraine, including heavy military equipment. This trend has only escalated the conflict, and prospects for an end to the war look bleak. Also, it seems that Ukraine's allies are gearing up for a much longer war. In his first trip to Ukraine since the beginning of the conflict, U.S. President Joe Biden met with his Ukrainian counterpart Volodymyr Zelensky. During his hours-long surprise visit to Kyiv, Biden said he was there to show his country's unwavering support for Ukraine.
And I'm here to show our unwavering support for the nation's independence, their sovereignty, and territorial integrity. And today, I hope we're going to have a chance to discuss how the United States and our allies, by keeping constant contact with them, our partners, can most effectively support you and your cause, Mr. President.
And later, at a joint presser with Zelensky, Biden promised increased arms deliveries to Ukraine.
We've committed nearly 700 tanks and thousands of armored vehicles, 1,000 artillery systems, more than 2 million rounds of artillery ammunition, more than 50 advanced launch rocket systems, anti-ship and air defense systems, all defend Ukraine, and that doesn't count the other $500 million we're announcing with you today and tomorrow.
Zelensky hailed the visit as a key sign of support, saying Russia does not stand a chance of winning the war.
This is an unequivocal signal that Russian attempts to win will have no chance. Together, we will protect our cities and our people from the terror of Russia.
While Biden was in Kyiv, the U.S. State Department announced a further $460 million in aid to Ukraine. The assistance includes $450 million in artillery ammunition, anti-armor systems, and air radars, as well as $10 million for energy infrastructure. Biden's visit to Ukraine was the first trip to the country by a U.S. president in 15 years. The visit came 4 days before the first anniversary of the breakout of the war between Ukraine and Russia. Moscow has repeatedly warned the West against providing Kyiv with weapons, saying it would only prolong the conflict. Now, Biden's trip has clearly sent a contradictory message to Moscow. That is, the influx of weapons to Ukraine will continue and that Washington exactly wants the war to go on. Since the beginning of the conflict in Ukraine, Western countries, particularly the U.S., have fanned the flames of war by sending arms to the country rather than supporting dialogue. Now, the U.S. has accused China of planning to send weapons to Russia in its war with Ukraine, warning Beijing that any supplies would cause a serious problem.
We have seen Chinese companies, and of course in China there's really no distinction between private companies and the state, we have seen them provide non-lethal support to Russia for use in Ukraine. The concern that we have now is based on information we have that they're considering providing lethal support, and we've made very clear to them that that would cause a serious problem for us and in our relationship.
Blinken said he had made it clear to his Chinese counterpart Wang Yi during the Munich Security Conference that Beijing would face consequences if it moved ahead with assisting Russia in the war. The warning comes as the U.S. has been the largest provider of weapons to Ukraine during the year-long war with Russia. In reaction to Blinken's comments, China rejected the accusation, saying it's the Americans who are endlessly shipping weapons to the battlefield.
It is the U.S., not China, that is providing a steady stream of weapons on the battlefield. The United States is in no position to make demands of China. We will never accept the U.S. pointing fingers at Sino-Russian relations or even cursing us.
China has expressed deep concern over the Ukraine conflict getting out of control. Beijing has also urged certain countries to stop adding fuel to the fire while pledging to promote dialogue to resolve the conflict. We'll be right back.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the Limelight.
On Friday, February 25th, 1994, the 15th day of the holy Muslim fasting month of Ramadan, the Jewish terrorist settler Baruch Goldstein broke into the Ibrahimi Mosque, also known as Cave of the Patriarchs, because it includes shrines and tomb of prophets, located in the southern West Bank city of Al-Khalil, as Muslims were performing the dawn prayers on a Ramadan day and opened fire on the worshippers, killing 29 on the spot before he was neutralized by the worshippers. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Wafa News Agency wrote in this regard, February 25th marks the 29th anniversary of the Ibrahimi Mosque massacre, which resulted in the death of 29 Palestinian worshippers and the injury of 150 others. Yet, 29 years later, the victims are still paying the price for the massacre. On Friday, February 25th, 1994, the 15th day of the holy month of Ramadan, the Jewish Zionist and terrorist settler Baruch Goldstein broke into the Ibrahimi Mosque, located in the southern West Bank city of Al-Khalil, as Muslims were performing the dawn prayers on a Ramadan day and opened fire on the worshippers, killing 29 on the spot. The Zionist regime occupation troops present in the area closed the gates of the mosque to prevent the worshippers from leaving, and they also prevented those coming from outside from entering it to help the wounded. But the 29 were not the only victims of that massacre. That same day, the Zionist regime occupation troops opened fire at Palestinian participating in the funerals of the dead, killing 21 more people. With tension escalating in the occupied territories, the Zionist regime troops opened fire at protesters the next day, killing 10 more and wounding hundreds of others. Following the massacre, the Zionist regime occupation forces closed the Ibrahimi Mosque and Al-Khalil's old city for a full 6 months, claiming to investigate their crime. They unilaterally formed the Shamgar Commission to investigate the massacre and its causes, which came out at the time with several recommendations, all against the victims and favoring the Zionist terrorist settlers. The recommendations included dividing the Ibrahimi Mosque between Muslims and Jews, creating new facts on the ground that worsened living conditions for the area's Palestinian residents, tightened security around the Holy Mosque, giving the occupation authorities full control over the mosque in order to continue to turn into a Jewish shrine, and preventing the call to prayer from its minarets many times during the year, as well as closing it for Muslim worshipping many times in the year, while opening it fully for only Jewish worship. Shortly after, the occupation authorities placed